Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Astera Credit Union, a proud supporter of Current State's Neighbors in Action segment. Newest location is now open on West Saginaw Highway on Lansing's west side. Information at asteracu.com.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. We've got, I think, a really interesting hour on the way. Today, of course, is a big day for the Lansing-made Cadillac CTS. Coming up on the program, Dave Leone is the executive chief engineer of Cadillac, and we're going to talk about the new CTS, which will start rolling off the line at Lansing Grand River later in the year. Also, Alice Brinkman is the founder and director of the Reach Studio Art Center, and I believe this art center is a part of the RioTown Renaissance here in Lansing. So we're going to get Alice's take on what she does. It involves art in RioTown, and she is coming up on our Neighbors in Action segment. But first, back in December, Governor Rick Snyder signed legislation paving the way for Michigan to become America's 24th right-to-work state. The controversial law takes effect tonight at midnight. Right-to-work prohibits mandatory payment of union dues as a condition of employment. Supporters, which include many Republicans, including Governor Rick Snyder, call the bill pro-worker and says it creates jobs. Opponents call it anti-union, anti-worker, and bad for the economy. Arguably, right-to-work has been the single most talked-about development in the state in recent months, possibly years. And here on the day before the law takes effect, we welcome two guests to discuss it. Jim Holcomb is Senior Vice President and General Counsel of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
And the Chamber was and is a right-to-work supporter. Doug Pratt is a spokesman for the Michigan Education Association, the state's biggest teachers union, which opposes right-to-work. Hi, Doug.
Good morning.
And full disclosure to start out here, WKAR Radio is affiliated with a union, and its members are represented by the Michigan Education Association. So, Doug, I got to bring it today, okay?
Bring it on.
He says bring it. I want to open by asking both of you how you feel about today, given what's happening. Jim Holcomb, is the advent of right to work a good day for Michigan?
I think it's a good day. It's good policy in our members' belief going forward, but we don't certainly don't see it as it's going to be a monumental day where all of a sudden the sun comes up tomorrow and it's completely different landscape. This is, we believe, is going to be one element in continuing Michigan's revitalization, but it's not a silver bullet, but it is an important building block.
Doug Pratt, how do you feel about the last day of Michigan as a non-right-to-work state?
Well, it is a sad day, you know, for a lot of people, but I think it's another day in the fight for the middle class of this state. You know, right-to-work is nothing more than an attack on people's ability to come together and collectively bargain to have a better working condition, better wages, better benefits. And, you know, it is a sad day, but it's just another day in the continuing fight. This isn't over with.
Is there agreement regarding what exactly changes tonight at midnight? Are new hires at so-called closed shops, or what used to be called closed shops, are they no longer obligated to pay union dues?
Jim, no, the contracts stay in force until that contract runs out. So, you know, if there's a contract in place, it's still going to stay there until the next contract negotiation and re-upping at that point.
Okay. Jim Holcomb, how do you respond to assertions that unions are unquestionably responsible for higher wages, better benefits, better conditions, and so on, and that is a decision not to pay dues undoes that very basic contract?
Well, I certainly don't think it undoes it. Certainly unions are an important part of Michigan's history and the labor environment in general. But what this bill does and what this law is allowing is for people to make their own choice. Do they believe the union is right for them, and do they want to financially support it? All this does is says that you cannot be forced to financially contribute or belong to a union against your will. I would disagree with Doug on the standpoint of collective bargaining. Collective bargaining does not change under this law one bit. Everyone who wants to collectively bargain through their union still has that right to do so. All it says is the union can't force somebody to belong.
But if significant union resources are now in jeopardy, doesn't that reduce the ability of organized labor to promote their causes, to bargain, and to keep wages and benefits generally higher and better?
The only way union coffers could be significantly at risk is if their members don't believe they have providing good value and they don't want to belong anymore. At that point, what we're saying is it's the employee's right to make a decision whether they want to financially contribute. If the union doesn't have quite the resources to do what they want to do, that's because they haven't proven their worth and their value to the membership.
Or it's because, you know, there are forces out there. I mean, right now our members are getting robocalls from right-wing organizations saying, don't sign contracts. Don't belong to the union. Don't listen to what they're trying to tell you. We, for years at the Michigan Education Association, have been working with our members, showing value, but that's not what this is about. What Right to Work does, nobody is forced to join a union. That has always been against the law. But what Right to Work bans is the practice of including language in a contract that says if you don't want to belong to the union, you have to still pay your fair share of the cost of negotiating the contract. That is the only thing that Right to Work does. It makes that practice illegal. And so what you have is a situation where people can benefit from a contract without paying for it.
Is he right on that point,
Jim?
No,
he's not, because the U.S. Supreme Court has said numerous times that unions are allowed to have members-only contracts. What unions don't tell you is they don't want that because it hurts them. For instance, if you have a union contract and their layoffs maybe are based on seniority, you're going to want everyone within that contract, because if you have older workers who are under that contract, all the younger workers would just opt out of the union so they can't be the first ones laid off. All it is roping people into an agreement that they don't want to be a part of. You can have a members-only contract, and the union can say, we aren't going to represent you. But they don't want to do that for various reasons. Also, they don't want someone else to be able to negotiate on their own behalf. They may come up with a better deal. And then people in the union are going to say, well, why am I belonging to the union when I could do it on my own?
Doug, why don't you respond, then we'll move on.
The fact is, federal law says that if you have a union shop, if you have a group of people who are represented under a contract, you have to treat them all the same. The union has to represent everybody, regardless of whether or not they are paying. Now, that is a huge problem in terms of getting back to what Jim said about collective bargaining. These are people who are coming together and voting on a contract. They have a say. They have the ability to vote for a contract, up or down, based on their beliefs and what they want to do. And that's democracy. And this bill is fundamentally anti-democratic in that way.
I need to clarify one thing. It's not a true statement in my belief, and I guess the courts maybe are going to have to figure this out. But the U.S. Supreme Court has said you don't have to represent everybody. The NLRA, the Act, National Labor Relations Act, says you have the option to do that if you choose. It doesn't require them to do that. They do it for their own benefit, for a couple of the examples we just recently discussed.
Okay. Let's get some data out on the table. Both sides in this debate have pointed to numbers that they say bolster their case. Jim Holcomb, do you expect the number of jobs to be climbing in Michigan as a result of Right to Work?
Absolutely. We expect the numbers of jobs are going up. Michigan is on a rebound right now. This is an important step in that. As we stated before, I stated before, it's not a silver bullet, but it's an important building block. And Michigan is going to move forward. We're going to have more jobs. If you look at the data out there, personal income, state job growth, gross state product, all significantly higher in states that have freedom to work.
Doug Pratt, respond to that, please.
That falls into the category of fun with averages. If Bill Gates walked into this studio right now, we would all, on average, be billionaires. But we'd all still have mortgages to pay, unfortunately. The fact is, when you really look at a clean economic analysis of the data, Right to Work is not a factor. It's not a factor in terms of personal income growth. You look at the states ranked in terms of personal income growth, the worst state in terms of growth and the best state in terms of growth are both free bargaining states. The second worst and the second best are Right to Work states. No, unemployment. of the bottom six unemployment states right now. Three of them are right to work, three of them aren't. You know, but it gets presented as if this is going to be a game changer. It's not a silver bullet. I will give Jim the credit that he's at least not saying that. But a lot of the proponents of this are walking out there saying that this is going to increase income. This is going to increase growth. But when you look at the real numbers, right-to-work states on average, again, playing with averages, $1,500 less in terms of wages.
But Jim, there is this widespread perception that it may well create more jobs, but they are worse jobs.
But I would disagree with worse jobs. And also, $1,500, if you look at many of the states where freedom to work currently is, it's a lower cost of living. They're going to make less regardless. But their quality and their standard of living is higher, which is important.
Less health care, less pensions, more worker safety. I don't know how that qualifies as a better quality of life. I don't care what the cost of living is,
Jim. If you look at all the statistical analysis and the PhDs are looking at, that's the data they're coming up with when they look at all the figures and all the different elements that go into this.
So the Economic Policy Institute last year did a survey comparing something that the Indiana Chamber of Commerce did that controlled for seven factors, ignoring all sorts of things about the economy of a state and drawing conclusions that right to work is good. The Economic Policy Institute covered something like 50 different factors. That's a real study.
And
the Mackinac Center continues that.
We did one at the Michigan Chamber Foundation that covered 200. And what they say is personal income and freedom of work states between 2000 and 2010 up 40%. Michigan, 20%. Job growth. Michigan down 17%, freedom to work states up 5%.
What can you tell us about the hiring process now? I'm wondering if that's where the rubber may meet the road. Doug Pratt, if an administrator is interviewing a prospective teacher, will the subject of paying union dues come up during the interview? How will that work out? Do we know?
We don't know. I mean, it shouldn't. I mean, especially speaking from my standpoint, what should be coming up in an interview when you interview to hire a teacher or a school support person is their capacity to do the job. That's what's important, and that's what an administrator doing hiring should be talking about.
I'm really curious about how this is going to play out on the ground. That's really why I asked that question. Jim Holcomb, any thoughts on that?
No, I would agree. I would think any business, they're looking to hire the best person, whether you're hiring an educator in a school district or whether you're in a private business, or you want the best people in the best jobs so you get the best productivity.
Both of you expect dramatically different impacts from the very same law, but what about the timeline? Jim, the governor suggested that the passage of the law very quickly triggered some level of interest in the state from other companies. Have you looked at that? Is he right?
We've heard anecdotal evidence from people within state government saying that they've gotten a lot of contacts. We've also heard from many of our colleagues in states around the country who have, you know, other chamber executives that we talked to that said they were worried because many of their businesses in non-right-to-work states are now looking at Michigan, looking to leave other states and coming here. But it's all anecdotal at this point.
And Doug Pratt, what negative impacts from right-to-work are in store? And when are they going to be apparent?
You know, it's going to take time. I mean, this is not something that changes overnight. Just because the sun rises tomorrow doesn't mean things are going to be different in a lot of places. But it's going to be an issue that over time is going to have a negative impact on the wages and benefits of this state.
Doug, are you and other unions making efforts to promote, more actively promote, the benefits of dues paying?
You know, certainly we are. I mean, but that's not something.
You're stepping that up.
Yeah, we're stepping that up. Okay. But that's not to say that we haven't been doing it aggressively for a long time.
Okay. And there are, if memory serves here, four different legal actions, lawsuits involving right to work. Jim Holcomb, is the Michigan Chamber involved in any of these? Are you watching these?
We're certainly watching them. They're all kind of in the such early stages right now that there really isn't the ability or opportunity really for people to interject their thoughts, whether it's amicus or trying to file other lawsuits. So we're just kind of monitoring the situation. We were intrigued when the governor asked for the advisory opinion out of the Supreme Court. We haven't seen anything out of that yet, so we're still just kind of watching.
Doug, what about the MEA?
You know, we're involved in an open meetings lawsuit in terms of how they closed the Capitol down during all of this.
Right,
despite the fact that it was empty.
Open Meetings Act was violated during the
debate. That's what we contend.
Okay.
But I think we need to be clear on that. Just one point. The Capitol was closed down by the state Capitol Police. The legislators do not make that decision, and they did not make that decision. And also, the Capitol was open when the bill we're talking about was actually voted on.
Okay. We've got to leave it there. We could go on and on, but we've got to move on. Jim Holcomb is Senior Vice President and General Counsel of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber is a right-to-work supporter. Doug Pratt, a spokesman for the Michigan Education Association, which opposes right-to-work. Many thanks. Good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And for this week's public poetry announcement, current state producer Joe Lindstroth asked Stephanie Glazier, acting director of MSU's Center for Poetry, to think about poets who have written about labor and the working class in America.
A few people came to mind when you asked me to think about this. Jim Daniels is certainly one of them, but I settled on Philip Levine, who's a Michigan poet who was born in Detroit. And he actually started working in the auto industry at the age of 14. He went on to study at Iowa with some of the most famous American poets, John Berryman and Robert Lowell. He was later named Poet Laureate. He's won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. I think Michigan doesn't often claim him as being one of ours, and I am proud to say he is.
And even before he went on to his very illustrious writing career, he went to Wayne University at the time, State.
Mm-hmm.
And directly after, he worked in the auto factories in Detroit, the auto parts factories in Detroit.
That's right. That's what he's made of.
And that is the subject of a lot of his poetry, is a kind of a journalistic sensibility.
Very observational. And he's been criticized for that widely, but it is the thing about his work that makes it so accessible to people who might not otherwise read widely in the world of poetry.
I found an interesting quote that he gave Detroit Magazine in an interview many years ago,
mm-hmm.
In which he said, "I saw that the people that I was working with were voiceless in a way. In terms of literature in the United States, they weren't being heard. Nobody was speaking for them. And as young people will, you know, I took this foolish vow that I would speak for them. And that's what my life would be." The voiceless part resonates with me here because unions symbolically, and say what you want now, what unions have become, there are plenty of critics. That is why we have the right to work law. But I think unions were formed basically, if you think about it, if you reduce it to its barest and most simplistic terms, a union was there to give the working class people a voice in our capitalistic society. Instead of just being the worker taken advantage of, they collectively organized to give themselves some power against the owners and the people with money in this society.
I think that's right, Joe. And what poetry does is actually a similar function. It amplifies. Right. So what Philip Levine has done in this poem that I've brought today is amplify his experience and his roots and his community, the voices that he came from and the voices that maybe he wished he would have heard more of when he was growing up.
Out of Philip Levine's wide body of work, you chose what poem, Stephanie?
I chose a poem called Drum, and it places us right at the top of the poem with a note that reads Leo's Tool and Die, 1950.
So he's placing us directly into a factory, right
there.
A very
specific place at a very specific moment.
Give it a whirl.
Leo's Tool and Die, 1950. In the early morning, before the shop opens, men standing out in the yard on pine planks over the umber mud. The oil drum, squat, brooding, brimmed with metal scraps, three armed crosses, silver shavings whitened with milky oil, drill bits bitten off. The light diamonds last night's rain. Inside, a buzzer purrs. The overhead door stammers upward to reveal the scene of our day. We sit for lunch on crates before the open door. Bobek, the boss's nephew, squats to hug the overflowing drum, gasps and lifts. Rain comes down in sheets, staining his gunmetal covert suit. A steak truck sloshes off as the sun returns through a low sky. By four, the office help has driven off. We sweep, wash up, punch out, collect outside for a final smoke. The great door crashes down at last. In the darkness, the scents of mint, apples, asters. In the darkness, this could be a Carthaginian outpost sent to guard the waters of the west. Those mounds could be elephants at rest, the acrid half-light, the haze of stars striking armor, if stars were out. On the galvanized tin roof, the tunes of sudden rain. The slow light of Friday morning in Michigan, the one we waited for, shows seven hills of scraped earth, topped with crabgrass, weeds, a black oil drum empty, glistening at the exact center of the modern world. Drum by Philip Levine. With Current State producer Joe Lindstroth, I'm Stephanie Glazier with another public poetry announcement brought to you by the Center for Poetry at Michigan State University's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities.
The U.S. Supreme Court is set to rule on the affirmative action case Fisher versus the University of Texas this spring. However, before they hand down their ruling, the court will hear another affirmative action case out of Michigan, Schutte v. the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action. And to discuss the case, we welcome George Washington, the lead attorney for the coalition. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Before we move forward and look to the Supreme Court's hearing in this case, let's just quickly review how we got to this point. In 2003, the Supreme Court upheld affirmative action as long as there were not quotas attached. That case involved the University of Michigan. Soon after that, Proposal 2 was passed here in Michigan. Remind us what Proposal 2 did and how did it alter the Supreme Court's 2003 decision?
Sure. Yeah, Proposal 2 passed in November 2006, and it is about 247 words long, but the real content of it is four words, which prohibits the state from, quote, granting preferential treatment to, close quote, persons on account of race, national origin, and so forth. What that has been meant for years is letting in black and Latino students who have lower average grades, points, and test scores than white students. And it essentially killed affirmative action, and it's driven down black and Latino enrollment at the University of Michigan by one-third to one-half, as it did, as the equivalent proposal did in California 14 years ago.
So make your case. Your coalition found this objectionable. You organized and you started taking legal action. Tell us about your action.
Well, basically, what's wrong with the proposal is that what it results in is admissions not by merit but by privilege. That it's just clear that the schools, the secondary and elementary schools in this state, are unequal by race. It's clear that the tests are unequal by race, partly because they reflect the unequal education and partly because they're geared towards a certain curriculum and a certain population. And the net result is that what we have is at the exact moment that the country is becoming majority-minority, we're going to have one-third to one-half less black, Latino, and Native American lawyers, doctors, and political leaders of all kinds than we did before, and that makes no sense. It means, you know, tens of thousands of students will have their dreams dashed, but it also means that the country will be evolving towards a new form of separate and unequal, and that just is both objectionable and untenable.
How did you interpret the passage by nearly 60% of Proposal 2 in Michigan?
Well, I think you need to look behind that. 9 out of 10 black voters in this state voted against Proposal 2. 2 out of every 3 white voters voted for it. And if there's any lesson we should take from our history, is that a majority white electorate cannot deprive racial minorities of the right to fight for the only means that their children can go to school. They couldn't do it in the South, and they can't do it in Michigan.
How do you respond to people who say, hey, this country has elected a black president for the first time? Isn't that significant? How do you respond to people who make that claim?
Well, it is significant. It shows some of the progress we've made. On the other hand, all you have to do is drive south of 8 Mile Road and look at the city of Detroit or Lansing or Flint or any of the other major black areas of the state, and you can see that we have a long way to go, that we haven't reached equality for really the overwhelming majority of the population. And we can't take that little bit of progress and say, okay, let's stop.
Respond to the Sixth Circuit of vote. That came down 8-7, overruling Michigan's law. What was that all about? What's your take on that?
Well, that was the case we won, and that's what got us to the Supreme Court. What they basically said is that any citizen of this state can go to the regents or the trustees or the governors and say, you know, we think your admission standards are unfair as to us, or that there are not enough of us there. And people do that. People who want, you know, special consideration for people who are poor, or people who are veterans, or people from rural areas, or athletes, or legacies, or whatever. And what they said is, if you do that, you cannot then say that racial minorities cannot go to the regents or the trustees and say, we want a special admissions program, that you can't single out and prevent, take away that political right of racial minorities when they're the ones who need special admission programs the most.
George, is it known how the makeup of Michigan universities changed between the implementation of Proposal 2 and today?
Yes, it is. Yeah, now the University of Michigan in particular publishes the figures. There's about a one-third to one-half drop. And in the medical school, it's about 60%. The dental school, it's about 80%. And then at Wayne State in particular, at the law school and the medical school, which used to be, the medical school used to produce more black doctors than any school outside of the HBUs in the South. And it has dropped absolutely dramatically, which will mean less health care in the cities over time.
It seems as if both sides' arguments are based on their definition of equality, yet both sides have come to such different understandings of what that means. In the context of affirmative action, what to you is equality?
Equal, it means equal opportunity. It means the right of persons to go to university, persons, well-qualified persons to go, despite that they've had unequal secondary schools, unequal elementary schools. And I just say, you know, it's always been the case that people who seek to deny equality in this country have attempted to clothe it in the language of the 14th Amendment. It was, for example, separate but equal, which was claimed to be, you know, in compliance with the 14th Amendment. And now we have this no preferences language, which basically means that we'll enforce grades and test scores rigidly against racial minorities, even though everybody realizes those are not fair or neutral criteria.
George Washington is the lead attorney for the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court announced they will hear the case of Schuette versus the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action before ruling on the Abigail Fisher case. George Washington, thank you.
All right, very good. Thanks so much, okay?
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the New York International Auto Show this week, the Cadillac division of General Motors is announcing details of what will be new with the 2014 CTS, built proudly here in Lansing at the Lansing Grand River Assembly Plant. The third generation CTS will roll off the line later this year. And joining us from the auto show in New York City, Dave Leone, Executive Chief Engineer at Cadillac. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Good morning, Mark. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. The notable difference here in the CTS, or one of the notable differences, it's bigger than the previous version. The wheelbase is an inch longer. The body is 5 inches longer, and the roof line is an inch lower. And in spite of all that, you've made a lighter car. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, the car is actually about 250 pounds lighter than the current car. And we describe it as being longer, lower, and leaner. And we did that through the use of technology, premium materials, and more efficient design. The vehicle has all aluminum doors, which is a first for General Motors. We have extensive use of aluminum in the structure, suspension, front cradles, bumper beams, suspension components. We have magnesium engine mount brackets. We use the same award-winning architecture of the ATS that won the North American Car of the Year earlier this year, but we've expanded it. The wheelbase is about 5 inches longer than the CTS. The car is about 13 inches longer than the ATS as well.
Wow.
And the car has got the best driving dynamics and most agile handling in its class.
The CTS is a rear-wheel drive car at a time when a lot of cars are front-wheel drive. What does that mean in the marketplace?
What it means is the rear-wheel drive enables you to get a 50-50 weight distribution, 50% of the weight on the front tires, 50% of the weight on the rear tires, meaning you can get maximum handling capability and maximum steering response with that setup. And this vehicle is available in rear-wheel drive. It also has all-wheel drive. For those in the concern for the winter climates, all-wheel drive is available. We expect that to penetrate quite highly as well. But the rear-wheel drive really enables outstanding driving dynamics for those that want a vehicle that's fun to drive, engaging to drive with thrilling performance. The CTS could be that car for them.
And, we're real proud of this car here in Lansing because it's made here. What does the redesign, how does the redesign affect our workers at UAW 652? They build the CTS here at Grand River. How does that play out?
Well, it's a brand new, fresh design that we expect to be strong in the marketplace for the next several years. And what that really means is continued employment and job security with the fresh new products coming into the plant that are exciting, going to provide industry-leading performance. That means that there ought to be employment here for the extended future.
Do you see the redesigned CTS as more effectively competing against other makes and models?
Absolutely. You know, it's
which ones?
Well, the key competitors here are the BMW 5 Series and the Mercedes E-Class, but it has significant advantage over those products. It has about a 200-pound weight advantage over a BMW 5 Series in four-cylinder trim and a 350-pound weight advantage over the V6 versions. And what that means is the car is more engaging, it's got more agile driving dynamics and steering response. It means it stops faster. It means it will accelerate quicker. It's an outstanding car, something that is going to be very competitive in the marketplace, and we expect it to start to draw from their customer base. Our current ATS, about 53% of our current ATS customers are coming to General Motors for the first time, and their conquest sales from outside the company. We expect the CTS also to conquest a good deal of customers from the competitors.
Well, I tell you, the CTS has been the flagship model for Cadillac for a bunch of years, and I think everybody's real proud of everything that's rolled out in the past. But I'll tell you, the new model looks really, really exciting, too. Joining us from the auto show in New York, Dave Leone is Executive Chief Engineer at Cadillac. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Mark. Good to speak to you this morning.
For this week's Neighbors in Action segment, Current State features Reach Studio Art Center. The RioTown nonprofit offers art classes and art-related activities for kids and teenagers. And here with us now to tell us more about Reach Studio Art Center, Alice Brinkman is the founder and director of the Reach Studio Art Center. Welcome to Current State, Alice. Nice to meet you.
Nice to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your organization then.
Yes, well, Reach Studio offers both free programming and fee-based programming. And really our free programming is sort of the heart of our mission at Reach, which is to provide art activities, art-making activities for kids. especially kids that can't access out-of-school art programming, which tends to be expensive or hard to get to.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a couple of free programs, which really we focus a lot on for our grant writing and fundraising. And these programs include Creative Connections, which is for ages 7 through 12. And that meets every week. The kids come once a week for 2 hours after school throughout the school year.
How long have you been up and running?
We've been going for 10. Well, this is our 10th year.
Okay.
Yes.
So you were on board the Rio Town Renaissance way ahead of a lot of other people. You've been down there doing this for a while.
That's right. Yes.
I think Rio Town has generated an awful lot of interest just in the last few years, but
yes.
You've been there a decade.
Right.
Tell us about the fee-based activities then. You what do you offer for these fee-based?
Well, as a full spectrum of what we do, we have programming for ages 2 through 18. We do a little bit of adult stuff, but our main focus is with youth. And so we have a after-school kind of all kinds of art class that meets Monday afternoons, which is a low fee. We try to keep our fees low. Our purpose is to make art accessible. So, and that alternates with a kids' clay class. We have a TOTS class. It's called Creative TOTS for parents to come with their preschool age child and do 45 minutes of art each week for 5 weeks. And that's a real popular program. We run that all through the year.
What little kid doesn't love
exactly
art?
Yeah.
I mean, this must be so rewarding to see the
absolutely.
Little ones come in, especially, but the teenagers as well.
Well, yeah,
I
mean, I'm completely rewarded by seeing, you know, all ages. We have a teen studio program, which is also one of our other free programs. And they are doing amazing things in the community. They're focusing on community art projects and portfolio building. And, you know, we had, for example, we had one teen student a year ago who was involved with our teen studio program and mounted her own photography show.
Great.
Got so excited about that and working with a mentor, doing that, an artist mentor, through our program. And she became, through the summer, became very excited about continuing in the arts in college. And the other beautiful thing is that she got very excited about her home. Lansing area.
Have you been at this for 10 years, though? Have you
yes.
had kids mm-hmm. stay with you for the whole time? I mean, and you cover 2 through 18,
right.
mathematically. Have you had kids who have stayed with you for a full 10 years?
Well, some of our, you know, our, over the 10 years, of course, when we started 10 years ago, we had a handful of neighborhood kids that came in for some art activities. So, not all of those programs have gone for 10 years.
Okay.
But, yes, we've had another student that we've had among many has been with us for several years. And this young lady is on the autism spectrum. And it has been amazing to me to see how, after her repeated coming to reach for our, she usually comes to the Monday afternoon art classes, and she has developed amazingly. You know, when she started, she wasn't focused. She got upset very easily. She had a hard time relating to the other kids, and to watch her now is such an amazing thing to see how she's. Art has really worked on focusing her and helped her to meet other kids, to be able to, make friends and become more mature at relating to other students.
You're involved with a circus of some
Well, our Creative Connections, again, back to the free programming, our two main big free programs are our Creative Connections, which is ages 7 to 12, and then our Teen Studio, which is 13 to 18-year-olds, as well as during the summer, we also have an art truck program, which is a whole other thing. But for the Creative Connections program, we've been able to do some amazing projects, which include this semester where the kids are working on a circus. We're calling it Cirque d'Art. And they are... just yesterday, actually, they were creating, we had our room filled with boxes, big boxes, and they were cutting boxes and creating a cardboard arcade.
Okay.
And so they're going to set up games. They're working on some little performance pieces. They're doing costumes. They're making instruments. And the circus that they're putting together is going to be part of the Be a Tourist in Your Own Town Day on June 1st.
Excellent, excellent. And for our listeners who like what they hear, how do they hook up with you and give you some support? How do they get involved?
Sure, yeah. Well, we have a website, and it has a lot of information about our programs. We're getting our summer camps, our summer art camps put up on the website as we speak. And so... They can go to our website, which is reachstudioart.org.
Reachstudioart.org.
Yes, okay. Or, of course, call us at 517-999-3643.
Very good, very good. Alice, thank you very much for joining us. Alice Brinkman is founder and director of the Reach Art Studio Art Center. We could always use more nominations for our Neighbors in Action segment. We know there are great people and organizations out there that are doing great work, and we don't know about them. If you'd like to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured in the great work they do. You can even nominate yourself if you like. In fact, today's segment of Reach Art, the Studio Art Center, was nominated by our very own TV station manager, Susie Elkins. Thanks for joining us on Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Jokes about Jesus's image are everywhere.
I like to picture Jesus in a tuxedo t-shirt because it says, like, I want to be formal, but I'm here to party, too. Because I like to party, so I like my Jesus to party.
I like to picture Jesus as a ninja fighting off evil samurai.
All right, I'll be the one to say it. How do we know you're really Jesus?
I'm mainly here to correct a major error that you people have been basing the faith on.
What's that?
Jesus wasn't white. Jesus was black.
However, underlying this humor are the conflicts of race, which continue to persist in America. Today I'm joined by Edward Blum, a historian of religion and race in America at San Diego State University and co-author of the book, The Color of Christ, The Son of God and the Saga of Race in America, which looks at how the varied configurations and depictions of Jesus tell the history of race in the United States. Welcome to Current State.
Glad to be here.
Let's look to the Bible first. Are there any descriptions of what Christ looked like, reliable descriptions in the text of what Jesus looks like?
Even though there are four biographies, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, no description of hair, skin tone, eye color, no discussion of that at all.
Any other reliable early depictions of Jesus?
No. For the first couple hundred years, the early church, these were people running around in catacombs. They were, you know, busily getting murdered in Colosseums, so they were not creating images. It wasn't until hundreds of years later that they started to even talk about, can we represent what Jesus looked like?
And in colonial America, the image of a white Jesus takes root. Is that correct?
Yeah, it takes root, though, after the Puritans destroyed images of Jesus. Part of the Protestant Reformation was, hey, these Catholics are violating the Second Commandment against graven images. So America's first colonists didn't have white Jesus images. It wasn't until around the time of the American Revolution and a little bit after that.
Well, are you saying then that there was a wider perception of Jesus as being a person of color in the Catholic Church?
At times there were. In the Middle Ages, there's actually a couple hundred black Madonnas and black Jesus figures kind of circulating all over Catholicism. And if we look at South America, we see the emergence of Our Lady of Guadalupe, who was a mestiza Madonna when the Spanish interacted with Native Americans.
So there's a pattern here. The dominant race depicts Jesus according to that dominant race. Is that a general pattern, we can say?
It sometimes is if you have a theological inclination to do it. So if you actually want to use images to teach children. And you have to have power, right? To create an image, you have to have time, for instance. You know, slaves don't have time to sit there and, what color do I, how do I want to paint Jesus today? You also have to have stuff. You have to have marble. You have to have paper. You have to have paints. So if you don't have those things, you can't produce it. And then finally, reproduce it. Who has the ability to reproduce an image, whether it's on paper or in film? Only certain people have those powers at certain times.
So over time in the United States, a Jesus of color slowly begin to emerge?
Okay, we have three times where Jesus is non-white, three kind of moments, and they're all in the 20th century. The first is during the Harlem Renaissance, when you get African-Americans like W.E.B. Du Bois or Marcus Garvey creating a kind of pro-black culture. Then we get it in the 1950s and the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement, and we get the rise of black liberation theology from folks like James Cone. And then now more recently, we get black Jesus in our comedic culture. So you can hear Chris Rock, the comedian, talking about, Jesus was black. So those are the three iterations of Jesus as colored throughout the 20th century.
Your book looks at how this image of Jesus has been used as a means for suppression as well as a tool for empowerment. Maybe one of the most interesting cases of this dual role is the image of Jesus during slavery. The depiction of Jesus during slavery is that of a white man, yet it's an image that both master and slave take comfort in. How does that work?
So the master sees Jesus as the suffering servant and then tries to teach slaves, like, hey, it's okay that you're a servant. Look, even God's son was a servant, so that's okay. Slaves take it and they meet a white Jesus and this is a Jesus who comes to redeem them, not to rape them. He's a Jesus who listens to them. There was a slave song that went this way. He owns me and I own him. And to think about that, these are people who don't own anything. They're owned by other people. To think that they own the Savior, they own a white man. So in fact, the white Jesus in that capacity, he acts unlike other white men. And so what it does is it kind of takes away white power, even though Jesus himself is white. He's a friend to them, a good man to them, not a terrible man to them.
So beyond slaveholders, are there other groups that have used this image of Christ, in your view, to justify this supremacy?
The most obvious case is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who the Mormons, who have a white Jesus, and they also have a racial theology where Brigham Young argued that if a white person had sex with a person of African descent, that white person should be beheaded, okay? Not just thrown out of the church, but it was that much of a sin. So for them, having a white Jesus was part of that white bodies were more sacred than other bodies.
What do we know about the LDS today? I mean, how has that attitude gone forward here into the 21st century? Is it extinct? Are there signs of it? What?
Well, in 1978, the church had a new revelation that opened up their priesthood to black men. Before 1978, you couldn't be a full member if you had any African descent. So on one hand, they've changed quite a bit. since 1978. But before that, in the 1960s, they took a gigantic white marble Jesus and started putting it in their welcome centers. So if you want to go, you know, join the church, you walk through, oh, here's a big, huge white Jesus to welcome you. So it's kind of like, you know, we give with one hand and take away with another.
Do other countries, I mean, is the appropriation of the image of Jesus unique? Is this uniquely American, or this is more widespread?
Well, all, you know, throughout the world, you know, anyone who's dealing with Jesus at some point deals with a material incarnation.
Right.
What's been so fascinating is how in the 20th century, we've become an exporter of Jesus imagery. So if you can go, you go to Africa, you can go to parts of Asia and put up a poster of Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ with Jim Caviezel, the actor, playing Jesus on it, you can find locals actually going up to it and touching it as if it's sacred because of the power of media. The most viewed movie in world history is a film called Jesus. 1 billion people have seen it. All the actors are played by Middle Easterners except for Jesus, who's played by an Englishman. And the film was made in 1970, and so it's become a kind of image for the world. Not that we can't. We can find Ethiopian Jesuses. We can find Asian Jesuses, but even the dominant one.
Asian Jesuses.
Yeah, really? known as the brown-skinned one. But these films still play a role even globally, that we have a global export. Just as Michael Jordan and the Swoosh are exported,
right,
the white Jesus is exported too.
What does the community, there must be a community of historians, reputable historians, who study ethnicity, ethnic movements geographically. Is there any kind of consensus on where Jesus lay amongst members of that community?
How do you mean?
I mean amongst people who study this academically, who study the history of ethnicities in the Middle East 2,000 years ago.
Oh.
Is there any kind of consensus there?
Yeah, so there is a sense that what did Jesus really look like 2,000 years ago? The consensus is brown-skinned, probably short hair, probably short himself, brown eyes, and actually Popular Mechanics put out a Jesus, what he would have looked like. And so it's that definitely not white, definitely not blue-eyed.
Edward Blum's a historian of religion and race in America at San Diego State University and co-author of the book The Color of Christ, The Son of God, and the Saga of Race in America. He speaks tonight at 7:30 at the MSU Union at an event sponsored by the Department of Religious Studies. Edward, thank you.
Great chatting with you.
Tomorrow on Current State, please join us. We've got the book Summer of 68, which looks at the glory of baseball as the country was struck by rapid change and tragedy. Also, we'll hear from legendary musician James Galway tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for his production assistance, Yensia Wong for production assistance as well. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by City Pulse, which this week examines proposed solutions to the City of Lansing's short-term and long-term budget needs. Available now on newsstands and at LansingCityPulse.com.